Across the Pacifica Network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, November 13, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Iraq agrees to let the weapons inspectors in. Further INS crackdowns. Today, new policy regarding the removal of refugees arriving by sea. And in a South America spotlight, we look at both the new president of Brazil and the upcoming presidential race in Ecuador. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. For a fifth consecutive day, hundreds of students rallied in universities in Tehran, voicing their opposition to last week's death sentence of reformist university professor Hashem Agajari. Pejmun Hagigi reports.
Last week, a court in the western city of Hamadan convicted Professor Hashem Agajari of blasphemy and sentenced him to death following a two-month-long closed trial. Outraged by the verdict, students announced their opposition and have organized rallies since Sunday on university campuses. Daria is a student activist and newspaper journalist in Tehran.
Rallies have been organized by the Islamic student societies, and because students are much more aware and experienced compared to 2 years ago, they haven't let vigilantes turn the rallies violent. After 2 years of silence, it feels like the city and the students have been reborn, and we are not planning to stop.
Agajari, a professor of history, a war veteran, and a prominent member of the Islamic Revolution's Mujahideen organization, spoke last August at a function commemorating the late Iranian intellectual Ali Shariati, criticizing the notion of taqlid or emulating in Shiite Islam. While recommending further consideration of the verdict, the judiciary called Agajari's speech insulting to Muslims and accused the parliament of over-politicizing the country's atmosphere. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pejman Hagigi.
Close to 100 Afghans and Kurds from Iraq are taking refuge in a church in France, threatening to set the church and themselves ablaze unless they are granted asylum. Nicolas Champeau reports from Paris.
French officials closed the Sangatte camp to newcomers 10 days ahead of schedule. Many refugees who found the doors closed were left wandering under the rain. Many of them were arrested and handed a deportation order with threats of being jailed if they didn't comply. They have been released since and are still squatting a church near the harbor. As media coverage on the issue got bigger, the state representative decided to offer them accommodation and promised that France would examine their claim. Most of the refugees, however, refused to trust the state préfet. Many prefer risking their lives by attempting to enter Britain illegally on trains traveling through the tunnel. Dozens of Iraqi Kurds have recently announced they were prepared to take on the préfet's offer, but they want to support the Afghans who are still undecided. Nick Champeau, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Neither the Supreme Court nor the governor of Virginia have acted on the clemency request of a Pakistani man sentenced to death for the murder of two CIA workers and the cause of protests and prayer vigils in Pakistan. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
Mir Imal Qasi is scheduled to die by lethal injection Thursday night for shooting to death two CIA employees in 1993. Qasi has requested a stay of execution from both the Supreme Court and Virginia Governor Mark Warner, although Warner's office said today it was customary for the governor not to release his decision until after the court has spoken. The Associated Press reports that students continued to protest the execution in the Pakistani city of Multan, chanting anti-American slogans and threatening the security of Americans in Pakistan. The State Department issued a warning that the execution could lead to retaliation against Americans around the world. Imal Qasi has refused to condemn attacks on American government institutions, including the September 11th attack on the Pentagon, but urged his supporters not to attack American civilians in retaliation for his execution. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Traditional Oneida people believe they are being systematically evicted from their homes by another Oneida man who's determined to develop the land. Amanda Holmes has more from New York.
The traditional Oneidas of central New York, who remain on their 32 acres of ancestral homeland, have been served forcible inspection notices under a beautification project created by Ray Halberter, the CEO of Oneida Indian Nation, Inc., and the man recognized by both the federal and state government as the head of the Oneida Nation. The forcible inspections are to occur throughout the territory this Thursday, carried out by the corporation's all-white police force, privately hired by Halberter. In April of 2000, Halberter ordered all traditional homes on the territory condemned and destroyed if they did not meet his private housing code regulations. After the test case eviction and home demolition of outspoken Oneida activist Danielle Shenandoah, the rest of the Oneidas fear a similar fate of inspection and demolition of their homes and exile from their territory. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Amanda Holmes in New York.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
With the news that Iraq has agreed to allow weapons inspectors into the country as per last Friday's UN Security Council resolution, a United Nations team will leave for Iraq Monday. We are joined by correspondent Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
Iraqi television has just announced that the Iraqi government has submitted a letter to the United Nations Security Council announcing that Iraq will comply with Resolution 1441. This is the United Nations resolution that was passed unanimously last week. This is Washington's resolution. This is an announcement that is certain to be met with joy here in the Iraqi capital, where over the last 24 hours, tensions have been raised and people have been very, very nervous after the Iraqi parliament voted unanimously to reject Washington's resolution. Now, it must be stated that the overwhelming majority of people here understand that this does not mean that war is averted, but simply delayed. The official position here and the view on the street is very much that the Bush administration is intent on attacking Iraq, regardless of how cooperative Baghdad is with UN weapons inspections or with the resolution as a whole. But for now, people are very, very happy that at least they know that war has been temporarily averted. Now, what Iraq's acceptance of this resolution means is that Hans Blix, the chief weapons inspector from UNMOVIC, that's the UN Weapons Inspection Agency, will be arriving in the Iraqi capital of Baghdad on the 18th of November. He will come with his Egyptian counterpart, who is in charge of the nuclear inspections that will take place in Iraq. They will have discussions with Iraqi officials laying the groundwork for the beginning of the work of the weapons inspectors. Now, the official position of the government of Iraq still remains that this resolution is providing the Bush administration with a cover to attack Iraq, that it is a violation of international law and is contrary to the United Nations Charter. But the spin that's being put on it here is that the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has made this decision to show the world that he believes in diplomacy and believes in peace. And the decision that Iraq has now made to participate in this resolution, to cooperate with it, comes with the backing of the Arab League and certainly the overwhelming majority of Arab countries in the world, as well as the overwhelming majority of governments in the world, all over the last several days encouraging Iraq to comply with this resolution despite its objections to what it says about Iraq's independence and its sovereignty. So the latest news from the Iraqi capital is that Saddam Hussein's government has sent a letter to the United Nations saying that the Iraqi government intends to cooperate fully with Resolution 1441. This is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
Democrats in the Senate appear to be bowing to the will of the incoming Republican regime already. Senate leaders say they may already be agreements on the Homeland Security bill, so reviled by federal workers' unions. As a peace offering, the New York Times reports the Democrats have given the nod to a pair of judicial nominees they'd previously opposed. Josh Chaffin looks at the controversy behind one of those nominees, the Honorable Dennis Shedd.
To civil rights advocates, U.S. District Court Judge Dennis Shedd starts from the indefensible position of having served 10 years under Strom Thurmond. The retiring South Carolina Republican senator tried to filibuster the Civil Rights Act of 1957, and he's been known to call homosexuality a mental illness. But civil rights groups aren't happy with Shedd's own record either. Here's the National Organization for Women's Olga Vives on a sexual harassment case called Roberts v. Defender Services Incorporated.
He argued that even though the plaintiff had made a formal complaint about the abuse, the woman hadn't provided sufficient evidence as she perceived the environment to be abusive. He usually sides with the employer. Very few times, if ever, he has sided with the plaintiff in these cases.
In happier times for his party, earlier this year, New York Democrat Senator Charles Schumer pressed Shedd to state his opinion on abortion in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
And how about as it affects a woman's right to choose? Does the penumbra of privacy extend that far, in your opinion?
Let me say this. I would rather not comment.
The NAACP says Shedd's a bad choice for the Fourth Circuit, which includes the Carolinas, the Virginias, and Maryland, the jurisdiction with the highest percentage of African Americans. The group says Shedd made dismissive remarks when considering a citizen's complaint about the use of the Confederate flag. Shedd says his words were taken out of context. Republican Orrin Hatch accused the majority party of trying to smear Dennis Shedd's name.
It says a lot about Judge Shedd, especially in these times, that he allowed religious headdress in his courtroom. Judge Shedd also led efforts to appoint the first African-American woman ever to serve as a magistrate judge in South Carolina. He pushed for an African-American woman to be chief of pretrial services. He has actively recruited people of color to be his law clerks.
Senator Hatch becomes chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee when the 108th Congress comes back to town under Republican control in January. Previously rejected Republican nominees Judge Charles Pickering of Mississippi and Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen will likely come back to be named to the Fifth Circuit. In addition to Dennis Shedd, the New York Times reports Democrats have removed their opposition to self-proclaimed pro-life leader Michael McConnell for the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, a lifetime appointment which now appears certain. Republicans take charge of the Senate with 79 judicial vacancies to fill out of 862 positions. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
Today, America's post-September 11 doors closed a little bit more. An expanded U.S. immigration and naturalization policy goes into effect today concerning maritime refugee arrivals. South Florida's Haitian American community has been protesting for equal treatment for Haitian refugees. The policy since last December has been expedited removal and indefinite detention for Haitians exclusively. Now that policy has been expanded to include refugees of all nations except Cuba, who arrive in the U.S. via water. From Miami, Shannon Novak reports on the ongoing controversy and how the U.S. has legally managed to avoid U.N. international law.
Last December 3rd, 183 Haitian refugees were interdicted at sea and brought to Miami by the United States Coast Guard, after which the INS instigated a secret policy of expedited removal and indefinite detention for Haitians exclusively. The policy was exposed by the press. October 30th, over 200 Haitian refugees flowed onto South Miami Causeway and into INS detention. In response to the public outcry for equal treatment for Haitians, President Bush.
Immigration laws ought to be the same for Haitians and everybody else, except for Cubans. And the difference, of course, is that we don't send people back to Cuba because they're going to be persecuted. And that's why we've got the special law on the books as regards to Cubans. But Haitians and everybody else ought to be treated the same way, and we're in the process of making sure that happens.
It happens today. Maritime refugee arrivals from all countries except Cuba will be placed in indefinite detention and expedited removal, a policy that would normally be a violation of United Nations law. But the United States claims maritime refugees are a threat to national security, the one way out of the international agreement. INS spokesperson Mario Ortiz.
The INS is concerned that if we release this group of people into the community, then that would send a wrong signal back home. That could then trigger a mass migration into South Florida, placing people in peril, people endangering themselves at sea, causing federal resources then to be diverted to respond to such a mass migration. And those are the same critical resources that we need right now for homeland security. That's the reason we believe it has serious national security implications.
The policy mostly affects people of color. The largest group of maritime refugee arrivals are from Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Cuba. Monday, 8 Cubans flew into a Key West, Florida airport. The 8 will most likely be released to relatives, as Cuban refugees are protected under a 1966 U.S.-Cuban Immigration Act. South Florida community leaders fear that the difference in U.S. policy will cause dissension between Miami's two largest immigrant groups. Dina Paul Parks, executive director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights, says that instead of seizing the opportunity to change a bad directive that went out last December, they now are applying that bad policy across the board. Again, INS spokesperson Mario Ortiz.
In this particular case, we're looking at not a particular nationality, but rather a migration trend. And we believe that releasing this group at a time where there's growing concern, growing every day of a potential of a mass migration from Haiti, we're concerned that releasing this group is going to send the wrong signal and trigger others than to make such a dangerous peril.
Freedom, Vietnamese! Freedom! 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 Freedom!
Protests about INS policy are ongoing in Miami. A nationwide rally is scheduled for November 21st. 209 Haitians who arrived October 30th remain in detention. The INS has appealed a federal judge's decision to release some people with bond. Most, if not all, will be returned to the poorest country in the hemisphere, where they will begin a search for another human smuggler to take them out of Haiti, a nation with an 80% poverty rate and a life expectancy of 49 years. In Miami, I'm Shannon Novak, Free Speech Radio News.
9,000 members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union are locked in a difficult contract negotiation with the California-based Safeway Corporation. The company is demanding that workers for Safeway-owned Dominick's food stores in metropolitan Chicago accept cuts in wages and sweeping rollbacks in pensions, healthcare, and seniority benefits. On Sunday, 80% of the workers voted instead to authorize a strike if the company does not improve its offer. Chris Giovannis reports from Chicago.
It's not right. It is not fair. It's injustice to people who serve so long.
Ezekiel Rodriguez has worked for Dominick's Foods in Chicago for 14 years. He joined 80% of his co-workers in voting to authorize a strike against Dominick's owner Safeway Foods unless Safeway improves a contract offer that workers have characterized as garbage. And he echoes fellow workers in his charge that Safeway is seeking to squeeze concessions from workers to compensate for the company's management failures.
They wasted money flooding in their product. It didn't sell. Now they want to take back the mistakes. But they cannot support their employees who've given the servitude for them for service reasons.
3 years ago, Safeway Corporation bought out Dominick's Foods, a popular grocery store chain that had operated in Chicago and the city suburbs for 50 years. Safeway is the most profitable supermarket company in the nation, with almost 1,800 stores in the United States and Canada. Company profits have risen more than 60% in the last 2 years to $2.5 billion. Most Dominick's employees live in the same neighborhoods they work and send their kids to the same schools as their customers. But workers and many customers say Safeway management strategies have undermined service at Dominick's and hurt the chain's bottom line, and the company has projected lower earnings for the current fiscal quarter. Safeway chairman, president, and chief executive officer Steve Bird has insisted that the contract the employees rejected this weekend is the company's final offer, and that if workers strike, the company will shut down the chain and sell its assets. To employees in their union, that hardline approach smacks of a larger strategy.
Safeway hasn't stated publicly that, of course, that they want to bust the union, but if you look at their long-term strategy, how could you conclude otherwise?
Jim Papian handles communications for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union International, which represents Dominick's workers at more than 100 stores in metropolitan Chicago.
Steve Bird has stated publicly that his strategy is to roll back health care benefits 50%. He wants to attack pensions. He wants to freeze wages. Across the country, Safeway workers, UFCW members, have to stick together and fight back.
Employees say they can't survive on what Safeway is offering them.
Now, you can't ask someone to pay for health insurance and then take away their wages at the same time. It doesn't work that way.
Julie Turdick works at a Dominick's in suburban Countryside. She argues that Safeway executives like CEO Steve Bird are drawing down huge salaries at the same time rank-and-file employees are being asked to work harder for less pay and benefits.
Well, how much is enough money? He made $100 million last year. Well, that's not enough. I mean, how much is enough profit? I know business is about making money, but how much is enough? $100 million? $200 million?
Ezekiel Rodriguez has a message for Dominick's customers, rank-and-file UFCW members, and union supporters across North America.
Either way it goes, we stand together, we're unified, we're stronger. Stronger than anybody. We're stronger than the Safeway company. They know it, they're trying to break us apart. It can't happen. But bottom line, support what we believe in and support each other. Plain and simple.
In Chicago, this is Chris Giovannis of the Workers Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News.
On the condition that not a single shot be fired, nor a single building looted, in January 2000, Ecuadorian military colonel Lucio Gutierrez agreed to lead a well-planned, peaceful revolt by 10,000 indigenous protesters and hundreds of rebel soldiers that succeeded in ousting Ecuador's corrupt president, Jamil Mahud. After storming the Ecuadorian National Congress, Gutierrez, with two others, shared the reins of power for 180 minutes before they yielded to the Constitution and allowed the Vice President to assume the presidency. After serving 4 months in jail, Colonel Gutierrez was discharged. 2 weeks ago, to almost everyone's surprise, Lucio Gutierrez, one of the few Ecuadorians of indigenous appearance to ever run for president, won the first phase of Ecuador's presidential elections. Carlos Fabada caught up with the rebel-turned-presidential candidate last week in New York City.
Colonel Lucio Gutierrez was in New York recently, determined to win the trust of the international financial community. He met with representatives from the biggest banks. That evening, accompanied by his wife and an entourage that included Nina Pacari, an Ecuadorian Indian congresswoman dressed in traditional attire, he spoke at a community center on Roosevelt Avenue in Queens to a packed house of Ecuadorian American supporters, from whom he welcomed suggestions.
Vamos a mantener y a fortalecer la dolarización.
We will continue to use the U.S. dollar as Ecuador's currency, and to attract foreign investment, we will respect every agreement, every contract, every treaty Ecuador has signed and will sign.
This includes the OCP pipeline and the military base in Manta. Responding to a question from the audience about Ecuadorians working overseas, he declared,
"We will create a government agency to protect the rights of Ecuadorians working abroad. This agency will focus primarily on their children because we are concerned about what will happen to them without the love and the example of their parents."
Gutierrez says he's determined to combat the corruption which is draining Ecuador. Ecuadorians wonder if any president can deliver on the issue. By law, all Ecuadorians over 18 must vote. El Comercio, the country's top newspaper, reports that everything is ready for the November 24th runoff. Both the army colonel and the banana tycoon are broadcasting standard campaign promises like housing for the poor, money for health and education, creating jobs and building highways. Gutierrez says he's against more privatization and is offering to reduce the national sales tax. Last week, he met separately with the leaders of the armed forces, the national police, and the powerful Catholic Church. Quito restaurant owner Manuel Gonzalez says Ecuadorians must be careful when choosing their next president.
I see him as a troublemaker, a man who almost ended the democracy in our country. I believe he is not qualified to exercise the presidency of the republic. He has too many obligations with numerous political parties.
The two candidates have very different styles. Maria Fernanda Murillo of the Corporación Latinoamericana de Desarrollo.
They've got different styles of campaign. Lucio Gutierrez is meeting with everybody at the moment.
I asked her if Álvaro Noboa is connecting with the people and making alliances.
No, he's running on his own.
While many are awed by this tycoon's entrepreneurial success, and a few might believe he will save them, Manny Gonzalez and many Ecuadorians sense his motivation for wanting to win the presidency is mostly selfish.
He's not running for money. His goal is to obtain political and personal power.
This is Álvaro Noboa's second attempt at the presidency. He's still using his old campaign slogan, "Adelante Ecuador, adelante," or "Let's go forward, Ecuador." Both he and another wealthy presidential candidate, Jacobo Bucaram, exceeded the $1.2 million campaign spending limit, then gladly paid the known fine. In a developing country where, according to the UN, 80% of the people are poor, after relief from poverty, what many Ecuadorians both laugh about and cry for is stability. Maria Fernanda Murillo again.
This last elections in Ecuador, after 5 years of political instability, we had five or six presidents, some of which didn't even last a weekend.
Gutierrez is leading in the polls with a 20% margin. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Carlos Favara.
Basking in popularity after his landslide victory and 2 months before he's officially sworn in, Brazil's new president-elect, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has already introduced social issues into the public debate. In the country's 113 years of Republican history, Lula is the first president from a left-wing party, the first without formal studies, and the first former factory worker. By declaring a war on hunger in his country, Lula has kicked off a debate within Brazil. more social justice in a country where 10% of the population controls more than 50% of the wealth? Alexandre Spatusa reports from São Paulo, Brazil.
The first year of my term will have the stamp of the fight against hunger. I am sure that this is today the strongest clamor of society. If at the end of my term, every Brazilian can eat at least 3 times a day, I will have realized my life's mission. According to Lula's Workers' Party program, there are 44 million people in a state of hunger or undernourishment. This is just over a quarter of the population of Brazil. His government plans to boost up spending on hunger relief, a sum that can reach $2 billion in 1 year, a task which becomes even more urgent as Brazil now enters the yearly drought season. José Graziano, Lula's economic aide in the anti-hunger plan, said,
Lula tem repetido que a prioridade é o combate à fome.
Lula has stressed that the priority will be the fight against hunger. We plan to put in place an agile mechanism so that in the first months of the new government, we can face the consequences of a drought that is already taking hold of the country, a drought that is not only in the northeast region, but also in the center-south. The public debate is now going into the details of whether food coupons, magnetic cards, or cash should be distributed to the poor. This focus on social issues seems to be just what Brazilians voted for. Geolídio Alcântara, an unemployed security guard, I hope that Lula carries out a good government and that he keeps at least half of what he promised. Jobs, inflation under control, and also look after the people in the northeast who are going through a lot of difficulties. I think that the change that the nation voted for is to improve conditions in this country, because for us, workers, it's not easy. I myself am unemployed and am selling the stuff here to see if I raise some money. After 8 years of relatively controlled inflation and an increasingly open economy, people look at the resulting high unemployment and social problems and seem to want a president who actively looks after social issues. According to Claudio Coda, a political science professor at the Catholic University of São Paulo, Lula is the first president to openly declare his main task as reducing the social hardships of Brazilians.
I think that people voted for Lula because people consider that PT and Lula also are the most build-up leadership and the most build-up party to build in Brazil something like a welfare state.
Brazil is in the middle of a deep social and economic crisis. A slow economy, record high unemployment, rising violence, a depreciating currency, a bloated debt at 60% of gross domestic product, and a lack of foreign financing are large stones in Lula's shoes. Brazil has also signed a $30 billion agreement with the International Monetary Fund, under which Brazil has to restrict spending to guarantee payment of the debt. Professor Couto explains.
There are a lot of constraints to this government, and it's very difficult that a lot of expectations that PT's government creates in the population, and a lot of expectations that even PT's militants and PT's members expect that the party will do.
But for the moment, hope's still the key word in Brazil, and Brazilians know it's not going to be easy. Fernando de Paulo Emílio, a business consultant, sums it up. In my opinion, the outgoing government has paid a lot of attention to big industries and banks. There are no less than 12 million people out of a job, and I hope that he does something about this. Alexandre Spatusa, Free Speech Radio News, São Paulo, Brazil.
Today's newscast was produced by Cata Mesta at Pacifica Station, KPFT in Houston. I'm Deepa Fernandez.